Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hey, hey.
And you can probably hear by the noise, we're not in the Trainer Road studios, but we're here with this another special guest, Dan Emfield. How you doing, Dan?
Just fine. Glad to be with you guys.
Do you want to introduce yourself a bit, Dan?
If you want me to, happy
sure.
to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm old. Been doing this for a long time. I've risen to a spot of some notoriety only because I have outlasted everyone.
No, I
says you,
Dan. I think you're the most influential person in triathlon, and I think like you and your forum too sets a lot of trends. And you've actually Dan's waving to somebody. Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think you're very influential, probably the most influential person in triathlon. But where did you start off? Because you actually have set a lot of trends inside of triathlon.
Right.
Well, let's see. I did my first ever multi-sport events in the 1970s, and they were cross-country ski, bike, and run. And so that was sort of my entree into multi-sport. Unless you want to go all the way back to when I was a kid in the 1960s doing run, swim, runs as lifeguard competitions. But multi-sport has always been interesting to me. I did my first ever swim, bike, run triathlon in 1980, which was actually a bike, run, swim triathlon. I did the Ironman in 1981. It was the first year it was in Kona. And so I just was a sort of a triathlon enthusiast, and I won't go into my whole athletic background prior to that, but I started as a runner and then just sort of was a variety of single sport athletes as I migrated from one sport to another. I left triathlon as a sort of organized event. I really got motivated to do, I guess what you might call my own personal multi-sport events, mountain climbs that required the use of more than one mode of human-powered locomotion. So, you know, you ride a bike as high as you can, and then, you know, when you can't ride a bike any higher, then you run, and then when you can't run anymore, then you put on your crampons and grab your Piolet and you ice climb to the, you know, top.
Sounds like my type of race. Wow. I'd like that.
So I did a variety of those sorts of events that, you know, you're sort of both the race director and the field, you know, and the timer. But then I decided to get back into triathlons in 1986, and I started racing, and I noticed that some of the guys I was racing against, Scott Tinley and some of the fellows, were not going any slower in really cold water races when they wore their surfing wetsuits. So I thought I'd see if you could optimize a surf wetsuit for surface swimming and what that would mean. And through a lucky circumstance of living next to a domestic surfing wetsuit factory, having the ability to mess around in their factory with some of their pattern makers, I came up with a design that morphed into a wetsuit that when I swam in it was astoundingly fast relative to what I thought was going to be the case. And I decided that that was pretty cool. I think I'll be a wetsuit manufacturer, which I did. And I started a company, and it was called Quintana Roo. Well, I called it that. And wetsuits were our first product, and then bikes were our next product.
That's probably how people recognize Quintana Roo these days is due to the bikes, I would assume. The majority of people that see it from the outside in, yeah, it's cool.
Well, you know, 1987, which was the first year I came out with these wetsuits, it was a big tech year in triathlon because that same year, Boone Lennon came out with a Scott Aero Bar, the Scott DH Aero Bar. And so we all, you know, swam in my wetsuit and then we rode on Boone's bars. But it didn't take very long before most of us realized that bar, while it was fast, was not optimized when you just stuck it on a road bike. Mm. And so in 1989, I came out with a bike, really, that was just optimized for the bar. In other words, I sort of asked myself, what if you started with a bar and built a bike from the bar's back? And so I became a bike maker in 1980, a tri-bike maker in 1989. There really wasn't such a thing as a tri-bike prior to that.
Right.
Yeah. I moved into a new building and added a bike factory to my wetsuit factory, and off we went. So I did that until 1995, and I decided I would rather rule in heaven than continue to serve in hell. And so I sold it all to Saucony, and I ran their bike division until 1999, and then I left and started SlowTwitch.com, and that brings you to current.
So what do you think you're most known for out of all those three things? So I could call you the inventor of the triathlon wetsuit. Is that right?
Yeah, you could, but, you know, I'm known for publishing Slow Twitch, and that's because that we've had such a turnover in among people who do the sport that they don't really, most of them don't have any idea what I did before publishing Slow Twitch. So I don't imagine I'm that. I'm particularly known for that.
I found you through Slow Twitch. You're Slow Man on Slow Twitch, and then I learned about all the other history from Slow Twitch.
Mm-hmm.
I would say Slow
Twitch.
Most
people are too busy reading the forum and posting extremely urgent things, and they don't have time to read the.
That is true.
My history.
It's true.
I would say Slow Twitch is probably it's the tastemaker forum on the internet for a triathlon. A lot of trends, like between the bottle between the arms, that first came out of Slow Twitch. A lot of like innovations happened on Slow Twitch and then came out of it. Is that right?
Oh yeah. Well, you know, when I was a bike maker, I mean, bearing in mind that when I started making tri bikes, there were a whole lot of components that we didn't have, and so we didn't. I really didn't. You know, at the time, the preeminent bar was the Syntace aero bar, and those pads sat about 7 centimeters above the stem clamp. And so the only kind of pursuit, you know, we had road bars or we had pursuit bars. And so the only pursuit bars that we had were the kind that angled down after they left the stem. And the distance and height between the pursuit position and the pad position was substantial. And so we needed a fix for that. And so Profile Design made a bar that they called the Stoker bar, which was the bar that if you were the Stoker, meaning the rear person on a tandem, then this was the handlebar that you used. And it was like a pursuit bar, but it didn't have any elevation changed. It was flat, right? So, but it was too wide. It was 46 centimeter wide because it had to fit around the of the captain.
Yeah,
right.
Makes sense.
So I said, hey, Profile, can you make me a 42 millimeter wide Stoker bar? And so there's a whole bunch of things like that.
Yeah.
That make a tri bike today, from the brake levers, which have their own whole story of where those kinds of plug-in brake levers came from, most of which came from bikes that weren't tri bikes. They came from, you know, commuter bikes or you know, mountain bikes or something, and we, you know, they all got aggregated into what is now the tri bike. And some of the early guys like me and Steve Head and so forth, we just had to do a lot of experimenting and just coming up with. So it was a lot of fun because refreshing because we were making it up as we went along. We didn't really have any competitor to beat heads with. The only competitor we had was that no one was using any of our stuff. it was fun and challenging in the beginning because, I mean, if you go back to the very beginning, you know, you have this new wetsuit and triathletes didn't use wetsuits. And so you know, it's 1987. Where are you going to sell these wetsuits? How are you going to sell these wetsuits? Where? You're going to sell them in dive shops? You're going to sell them in surf shops? You're going to sell them in bike shops? You're going to sell them in running stores? And so there were these early fundamental decisions. You know, well, what? It's easier to teach someone who knows about rubber to sell a wetsuit, but they don't have the clientele. So it's harder to teach a bike shop guy how to sell rubber, but at least he has the clientele.
Yeah.
And so we decided to go there. But these early phone calls, you know, excuse me, sir, you don't know me, but I would like you to sell my product. Well, what do you sell? Well, I sell a wetsuit. Excuse me, you have the wrong number. I'm a bike shop. Click. You know, that was the typical conversation.
Right. Makes sense.
What I'd like to talk about mainly is our podcast is dedicated to making cyclists faster. I can't even say it. But you're also known for is bike fit. You're a big advocate on bike fit. And I'd like to kind of dive into that to make people faster. So first off, like, what makes a good TT or triathlon bike fit? Like, what should, at the end, how should you feel?
Like the guiding principles behind one.
Well, there's one guiding principle behind everything that I believe in bike fit, in cycling, in triathlon, and in life. And that is the notion of orthodoxy. And I feel strongly about that. As a matter of fact, I'm in the middle of writing an article about that. It delves into everything, including modern politics. You know, it's I don't know how you can believe in science when you go to the doctor, but decide not to believe in it when it comes to what climatologists say. And it doesn't have anything to do with my political bent. It has to do with you either believe in science or you don't. And the background, the backdrop, the guiding principle of science and medicine is orthodoxy. It's consensus. It's sameness. It's in this this notion that while everybody's different, everybody is the same is a truer statement than everybody is different when it comes to medicine. Otherwise, you go in there and your oncologist says, well, you know, bad news is you have cancer. Good news is I have all these colors of pills that you could choose from. Which color would you like? Well, you know, I don't know. Which one works? Well, I don't know. Everybody's different. I mean, how helpful is that? Well, you might as well just take the blue one then if that's your favorite color.
Right.
So the idea that good people do things similarly ought to rule how we approach things that matter. Now, how you fit on your bike, the most important thing about how you fit on your bike is it ought to be similar to how other people fit on their bikes. If there's any consensus that exists between how good people fit on their bikes. And so what I say to bike fitters is you should have a portfolio of your fits, and you should publish it. Just like a hairstylist publishes a portfolio of haircuts you've done so that someone can look at your haircuts and decide whether they want you cutting their hair or not. Right?
That's a good point.
Great. Yeah.
I mean, that's a really good point.
Yeah. And so we have a field on our database of fitters that's published on Slow Twitch for portfolio. And if you're a fitter and you're any good, you better have that field filled out. Because otherwise, why are you scared to show people what your fits look like?
So when you look at those fits, what do you like? Can you look through a series of images and be like, that's good, that's good. Ooh, that's not going to be good for that person. That's good. And what do you see?
Well, first of all, I see the same thing you see. When you're driving your car down the road and you pass a cyclist and you say to yourself, man, his seat's too high. What you're looking at is his included knee angle at bottom dead center. Now, we could hook leads up to particular landmarks, and we could measure his included knee angle, and we could see that it's 145 degrees and then know he's in the range. But you can just look at him and probably tell. Well, your seat's too high, your seat's too low.
Yeah, you're right. I can do that. I can look down and tell. And we went to Kona last year, and we would drive up and down the highway, and you would say, good, good, look at that guy. And then, that one's not so good. That's going to hurt later.
Yeah, that's not going to last.
So what if you have a bad fit, what what happens?
Like, how, yeah, what signs?
How is it different? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's just take let's take hip angle as an example.
Okay. Okay.
So hip angle would be, say, you know, bars too high or bars too low, or it would be bars at the right, you know, a particular elevation, but saddle too far back or saddle forward, which is either going to close or open the hip angle, right?
So I'm sorry to interrupt you. Saddle back would close hip angle. Saddle forward would open it up.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Now, I'm going to go fast and it's going to be technical, but...
We're ready.
Imagine a Smith machine. Okay, a Smith machine is a machine that you can do squats on, but because it's supported, you could actually step forward or rearward instead of having the... in other words, if you were doing squats on a free bar, you would have both mechanical advantage or disadvantage to be concerned with, but you would also have balance to be concerned with. On a Smith machine, you don't have to worry about balance because the bar is not going to fall over backwards or forwards because the bar can only go up and down vertically inside of a Smith machine. Mm-hmm. So you could sort of feel whether or not you had a mechanical advantage or not with a Smith machine, irrespective of the need to maintain balance. But what you'll find is that there's an aspect of your back. In other words, there's the angle of your back relative to the horizon that's going to work best. What wouldn't work, what you could physically do with a Smith machine is do a squat with your back completely vertical. But it wouldn't go very well. Your back's going to be bent at a certain aspect, and that's how you're going to be able to squat the most power. So what that says is that the more obtuse the hip angle, that does not mean you have the most mechanical advantage. And I use that as an example to say that it doesn't follow that the higher your bars are, the more power you produce. There is a particular place where you produce power. And if the bars are too high, you lose power. And if the bars are too low, you lose power. And so one thing I guess I'd say is that, you know, one way that that a bad fit is bad is you lose mechanical advantage when you're pushing down on the pedals because your hip angle is either too acute or too obtuse.
So how do I know if it's too high or too low, my bars?
One way is you raise them and lower them. And over a period of 2 or 3 years of experimenting, you figure out what works best. And the whole point of what I call a dynamic bike fit, which is, and a gold standard in bike fit, is you start pedaling, the fit's over, and then you stop pedaling. And you don't stop pedaling at all in between. And we test you in a variety of, say, saddle fore-aft positions, cockpit, you know, bars too far out in front of you, you're too stretched out, you're too constricted, the bars are too high, the bars are too low. So you go through all of this, and we can talk about what constitute drivers, what drives the fit. That is, what's important to you as a fitter? Is power production important to you as a fitter? Is the comfort of the rider important to you? Our body angles that you want to adhere to, is that what's important to you? So, you know, all those... are variously either metrics that drive the fit for one fitter or drive the fit for another fitter. But you go through this process, and really all that process is it's a, you know, 60 minute or 90 minute process of what we all went through back in the late 1980s that took us 2 or 3 years. So you as a rider can determine eventually if you're in any way proprioceptive and sensitive to your body, what works for you. We all found our positions. It took us a year to do it. And it took us a lot of, you know, well, I'm going to go to Bill Holland and have him weld me up a new custom seat post that perches me forward. Or I'm going to turn around this Nitto seat post that is a setback seat post, but that oddly I'm able to turn it around and make it a set forward seat post. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to use this mountain bike stem, or I'm going to use this track stem or something to, you know, to get the... So we all spent a bunch of money and had things welded and tried different things, and we got into our positions. And it took us from 1987 until 1989 to perfect the position, right? What a bike fit does, if it's done by a good fitter with good equipment properly, with a good protocol, is it just takes that two-year process we all went through and contracts it to an hour.
Is a lot of that down to the fact that we just have more available parts and everything else is more available, or is it because of, are you referring to the actual technology that aids bike fits? Or?
Well, there's two things. Number one is, I mean, when I started producing a bike fit class for fitters, for, you know, for people who wanted to be fitters, and really up through, I don't know, 2005, 6, 7, 8, I'd say, okay, here's the protocol for fitting, and here's the fit bike, and I'll, you know, we spend a week, and then I'd end by saying, you know, the good news is here's the tool, and here's the process, and here's how you do it. The bad news is, you see that tool, I had it custom made for me, nobody makes it for sale right now.
Right, okay, makes sense.
And so I had a tool made, a fit bike, and to give you two examples, I had it made so that it was collapsible. I could put it in a bike box. I could take it on airplane with me. And I took it up to Guru in 2005. And I said, you guys need to make this. You're a great custom maker. You make custom bikes and all four frame materials. But you don't have a process. Serrata has a process. You don't. Here's what a modern tool would look like. Now, it took them 3 years to make it. But as you noted, we're all at the Interbike Trade Show right now, and at the booth next to us is the Guru Trade Show booth, where they have world class fit tool. Mm-hmm. Another example is the Retool guys, where the Retool guys are constantly going back and forth to my fit workshops, and they had a 3D motion capture system, and they got cranky and irritable at me constantly saying to everyone who came to my fit school, the Retool tool. Motion capture system is a great tool, and it's the second most important tool that every fitter needs to have.
It's interesting. So it's
They decided to build the most important tool that the fitter needs to have, and they came out with a Retool Move. And so those two tools in tandem work great, but unless you can execute changes in position while the rider's riding the bike with metrics that spit out that allow you to port those metrics into a system to then prescribe complete bikes with granular detail, then you really don't have a fit system.
So I guess, so the principles themselves are the same. It's really just that we've had the technology that enables us to enact those more efficiently.
And those bikes are like, they're, for those who don't know, they're like stationary bikes where someone can say, move this up 1 millimeter this way, 1 millimeter this way, and kind of it all moves at once.
Right. And so all these fit bikes all work the same way. You know, when people come to take our bike fit workshops, what I tell them is that all these tools, whether the fit bike is made by Exit Cycling or Shimano or Purely Custom or Retool or whomever, they all, as long as they are sort of what we call XY fit bikes rather than angular fit bikes, they all work the same way. You can I tell these guys, you know, I'm going to teach you how to fit. I'm going to teach you how to be a fit ninja, right? Just like you're going to be Rambo, but instead of being able to kill with a knife or a helicopter, you know, you're going to be able to fit with a Retool or a Guru or Purely Custom. You can go to any one of these bikes, and I'll show you how basically it's all the same system. And really, most of these systems, whether it's the Retool system or the Fist system or the Guru system, they're all essentially dynamic fit systems that use we're all Protestants. We're all using basically the same system but we're different denominations of Protestantism, right? So Retool are the Lutherans of bike fitting, and I'm the Presbyterian of bike fitting, right?
Makes sense.
You know, we're all kind of going to heaven, pretty much. But you know, we differ a little bit here and there.
Exactly.
So how do you, in your view, people talk about this a lot, the difference between power on the road bike versus power on a TT bike or tri bike. How close can you get those? Can you make them just the same amount of power? We get this question a lot.
Yeah. And you know what? You are better able to answer that than I am.
Okay.
This is where I would defer to your judgment instead of you deferring to mine. Because you guys work in this milieu all day long of, you know, my Wahoo says my power is this. My Quark says my power is that.
That's right. Another problem.
Okay. That's another problem, yeah.
And then when I get out on the road, I find that none of them pay are in any way close to, you know, if I want to ride my FTP, you know, during an Olympic distance race, I'm finding I'm riding a very different power than what I'm able to ride during a stationary session. And this is a gap I have not been able to close. I'm going to leave this one to you.
So, okay, yeah.
Now,
okay.
Can I? But
go ahead.
For the purposes of bike fitting, I don't care. Because I still find that if you feel more powerful with your bars 1 centimeter higher than 1 centimeter lower on a fit bike, that will translate to the road.
Yeah.
I just can't say to you that the power that you're riding for 60 minutes on the road is going to be anything like the power you're capable of riding 60 minutes on a trainer.
Yeah, not on the trainer. I'm talking about just, like, let's say my FTP, I can put out on a climb on my road bike 300 watts for an hour, and then on a TT bike it's 260, right, when I'm in aero position.
Right.
So I think that maybe I would look at my hip angle and look at the height of my bars. I've been through this myself. Mm-hmm. I'm a tall guy, right? And I would switch my cranks from, I went from 175 to 165, I think.
Right.
Just to try to open my hip angle up.
Right.
I don't know. Do you have any advice? And
well, so basically, look, that a time trial position isn't necessary to compromise power output. Is that what you're getting at there? Yeah.
See, there's a lot we don't know yet. And so this issue you're talking about. So power is RPM or cadence times torque, right? So when you switch from 175 to 165, you lost torque.
Mm-hmm.
And you compensated for that maybe in two ways. One is by spinning a faster cadence or not, depending on whether you did. And the second is that you had a head start on the top of the pedal stroke because you actually had at top dead center a 2 centimeter bigger gap between a point on your torso and your knee, a point on your knee. And so you were doing, for lack of a more precise term, a half squat instead of a three-quarter squat every time you started to push down on the pedals, okay? So that's the trade-off that you made. The thing that we don't know, the thing that I don't know, is there's a morphology question. What if you have more type 1 than type 2 fibers? Does that mean that your cadence should be different? What if you're a slower rider in general, so that you ride 6 hours for an Ironman instead of 4.5 hours for an Ironman? Does that mean that your cadence should be different because the cadence isn't distance specific, it's time increment specific? It's you're doing a 6 hour ride, so your cadence should be lower. The only thing I know is I know your cadence should get slower as the effort gets lower. So, you ride RAM at 60 RPMs, you ride the hour record at 103 RPMs, right? And then everything in between is, depends on what the effort is that you're putting out at any given time on the bike.
Mm-hmm. Looking at bike fit, something that we're seeing in the triathlon world is a whole lot of talk about gravel racing and more people that are incorporating, I should say, just different aspects of it. From a bike fit perspective, do you see that changing? I mean, are we going to see people on gravel bikes, but since they're coming from the triathlon world, have a starkly different bike fit than other people, do you think?
Well, I don't see any difference between bike fit for gravel and for road. Now, I'm in the minority here. But I don't, one thing is, I try to never profess to know something that I don't know.
Right.
And so, people say to me, like a guy might say, okay, I want to come to your bike fit workshop, but I want to be taught both road and tri and MTB. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't teach MTB. Well, why don't you teach MTB? Because remember, my number one imperative is I'm going to teach orthodoxy, and orthodoxy is going to be demonstrated by a consensus in position that all the good athletes show one to another, not excluding the outliers.
Right.
And I can't find a consensus in MTB. And so until I identify the consensus, I can't teach it. Exactly. And so I can't do it. And so whether it's MTB fit or whether it's, you know, I can't find any way that gravel bike racers that are really good ride any different. You know, let me tell you, okay, here's the secret. You know who wins gravel bike races? Road racers. Yeah. that have a cross background.
Yeah.
You know what they ride? They ride their road bikes.
Yeah.
They ride their road bikes. They put on 25 or 28 millimeter tires, depending on what is the fattest tire their tire sponsor makes. And they go out and they win.
Yeah.
They win over all the guys who are like me, who are riding 40 millimeter tires. Right. And so what bike did they ride? We have a guy who rode Belgian Waffle Ride, who I hung out with, who won the Belgian Waffle Ride last year.
Yeah.
And his sponsor didn't want him to ride the ride last year because it was a big worthless exercise, right? Until he won.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he got all this press and was on all these bikes. So now he rides the Tour of California. It ends on seventh day Saturday, and he's supposed to ride 140 BWR on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And so, which he does, okay. But what bike does he ride? He takes the same bike he rode on Saturday and he rides it on Sunday.
Yeah.
Now, so when you ask me, how does gravel fit different than road fit, differ from road fit? How did it differ with this guy?
Right, yeah. Right? Didn't.
And so until I see some reason why gravel should fit differently than road, I can't say that because I haven't seen any sort of consensus among people who win gravel bike races that it's different than road fit.
Dan, one problem that I have, and I think a lot of other people have, is I have a pain in my neck while I'm in the bars. And I have a lot of drop, and I've raised my bars as high as they can go.
Yeah.
I'm on a Shiv,
yeah.
So it's a pretty tall bike anyways.
Yeah.
How do I fix that pain in my neck?
I'm going to say it, and you're going to laugh, but I'm not kidding.
To buy a new bike?
Surgery.
I'll do that. Surgery?
Yeah, you have spinal stenosis.
What does that mean?
That means that this you have all this calcified stuff going on in your neck that is impinging on your spinal cord, and as the older you get, you're going to start getting headaches.
I get them all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know this because right now, in my backpack, behind the seat that I'm talking to you on right now, is a bottle of Excedrin migraine.
Yeah.
Because I have the same thing. And I went and got an MRI, and that's what... So I can do one of two things. I can either keep raising the bars, or I can get surgery. I can go, you know, watch the TV. It comes on the TV. Come to our... I don't even know what it's called. You know, come to our spinal clinic, right? I don't know the answer to the problem other than that. Now, I haven't done that. Because I don't know, I'm just funny this
spinal
way, but
a little scary.
I just, you know, when some guy's gonna go in there with a scalpel around my spinal cord, yeah. I'm a little bit reticent about that. But I don't know the answer other than raise the bars or go to a surgeon. I don't know what the third answer would be.
So let's say,
I mean, okay, a mirror, right?
Yeah.
But we don't. Yeah.
Camera system.
Yeah, camera, but. Until somebody comes up with something that I'm comfortable with, because I'll be honest with you, I ride a tri bike like an open water swim. I sight every now and then.
I do that.
See where the buoy is, yep. Right? I also have a plate in my collarbone because that's how I ride my tri bike. So you know,
me too.
Yeah, there you go.
So how do I pick which tri bike to buy? Let's say I'm a triathlete. And I want to buy a TT bike or a tri bike, which there's so many.
Yep. Well, first, if you know what your pad XY is, that is, if you know where your pads are, the center or the back, either one, but I like the center the best. If you know the rise and run from the bottom bracket to that point on the pad, I can prescribe any tri bike in nature to you. I can tell you because it's math. It's just math.
Uh-huh.
And this is part of our, you know, this is part of our system, our fit system. So for us, bike fit is a two-part process. The first part is I identify your best position. And the second part is, okay, what bike fits that position? Now, nowadays, if you know pad XY, then you do some math calculations, high school trigonometry, and you generate a rise and run from the head tube top of the frame to the pads. And then you generate, and then you find the stack and reach of the frame that combined with that rise and run from the frame to the pads gives you a complete bike solution.
Can you describe stack and reach? I want to say, did you start pushing that? Were you one of the first people to push that stack and reach?
Well, I know that Gerard Vrooman and Phil White at Cervelo were playing around with this notion of rise and run from bottom bracket to head tube top, because back in 2002 and 3, we used to talk a lot. You know, I had dinner with Gerard last night.
I just took a picture of you guys together.
There you go. And we, you know, we would just, you know, it's like that movie. What's that? Remember that movie with those two guys at dinner? The whole movie was those two guys just talking to each other at dinner. My dinner with Andre. Yeah. Right. So that's like my dinner with Gerard. I mean, all we do is talk about this stuff, you know, bike fit and gravel bikes and all, you know, tri bikes and aero bars and all this, you know, that's just the whole, you know, it's 2 hours of dinner. And so we had this discussion back in 02, 03. And he and I both had this same notion, which is the way to measure bikes, the way to build bikes, the way to account for the differences in bikes and how they fit, was the two place. You got to measure the two places that you attach to the bike, which is the bottom bracket. You can't get around that. And the head tube top, because that's where the handlebars attach to the stem that attach to the steer column that passes through the head tube top. So you have to measure those two spots. And so there's an x-axis, a horizontal distance between the bottom bracket and the head tube, and then there's a vertical distance between the bottom bracket and the head tube, and that's stack and reach. So I wrote about that in 2003. I called it stack and reach. So those are my terms. And it was my idea to get us to part two of the bike fit process, which is, now that I know your position, let's mathematically figure out how to generate the bike solution underneath that. And that sort of just took off, man, and it ended up in everybody's geometry charts. And then it's, you know, they should be in our road geometry charts, and they're going to be in mountain bike geometry charts. And
thank you for that.
Well, like, I'm in the bathroom earlier today, and I see James Wang in the bathroom, who's a tech editor for, I think he works at Cycling Tips.
Uh-huh.
And he's probably the preeminent tech editor in the cycling business. And we're washing our hands, and he's at the next to me. Hey, James, the guy that strikes fear in all the bike manufacturers. And he says, hey, Dan, the guy who made all the bike manufacturers rewrite their geometry charts.
Yep.
And so, yeah, you know, but I never expected that. I intended to do something that was triathlon only and was only there to help me make a fit system. But, you know, history decided otherwise.
So how I look at it is, I know there's some bikes that, like stack and reach, that are good for me on a bike. And then I look for other bikes that are similar, or at least have enough stack, because I'm so tall.
Yeah.
And I want to have high enough bars. And then I think of what bar system can I put
it
on there.
You just put your finger on it. Nowadays, there's been a convergence in tri-bikes. All the tri-bike companies are converging in the geometries that they're using to make their frames. So 5, 6, 8, 10 years ago, stack and reach was how you fit yourself to a bike, because there were so many divergent trigeometries. Now there's convergent trigeometries, but divergent handlebar adjustment schemes. So now you really have to fit yourself to the adjustment scheme of the available bars. And so we make these charts now where we use rectangles or parallelograms to describe the entire adjustment range available on a bike. And if you do that, if you plot that on a Cartesian graph, you see that some bikes are really adjustable and other bikes are hardly adjustable at all. So for example, you have a bike like the giant Trinity Advance Pro.
And Chad's bike.
And it is hyper unadjustable its height, because there is 30 millimeters of allowable pedestal in their own proprietary bar. but it's fairly adjustable lengthwise, okay? And then you have like felt, for example, with the Felt IA that and the Scott Plasma Premium that are reasonably adjustable height-wise, but not so much lengthwise because there is one length stem, and that's it. And so you either have, and really, the felt is somewhat more adjustable. The Plasma Premium is very, it's the mirror opposite. I don't know if that's a term, mirror opposite. It is the Sounds opposite good. of the Giant. The Giant is rather length adjustable, but not at all height adjustable. The Plasma Premium is quite height adjustable, but not very length adjustable. So this is why we're migrating to Pad XY as the preeminent metrics for fit, because we can plot what's available for you bike-wise based on where you're actually going to connect to the bike, which is at the pads. We bypass the frame geometry altogether, and we just say, well, my pads need to be, you know, 640 millimeters above the bottom bracket and 510 millimeters in front of it. So what is the Pad XY range of a Speed Concept, of a Felt IA, of a you know, Giant, of a QR, and a Scott, and so forth? And then you make your choice based on that.
So where do I... Do you guys have a system on slow twitch? Like, how do I... Where I have to go to a, I think yours is Fist, right?
So I'm trying to build, I hope to soon build something which I think is going to be kind of cool, which is you tell me your Pad XY and it's a dot, and then you cycle through screens, and this each screen is a bike model, and over the dot is superimposed the Pad XY range of that model. So, cool. and then you can just cycle through. It's one app. It's, you know, one place. And then also, by the way, these parallelograms and rectangles and whatnot, they're also descriptive of how you fit on them. So, for example, let's say my Pad XY is 640, right? And Giant has a bike that will fit anywhere from 610 to 640. If my dot is at the top of that parallelogram,
yeah,
that where the bottom line is 600 and the top line is 640, I know that that's that size frame with 30 millimeters of pedestals because I'm at the top of the range.
I might not like that because my neck's going to be worse and worse as I get older, and I'm going to need some room to grow.
This is why you need to know. You need to see graphically where you fit,
yes,
inside of these parallelograms, because if you fit right in the middle, then you know that you can either put pedestals in or take pedestals out.
Yeah.
If you fit on the leading or trailing edge, that means if you ever want to be tighter, if you want those bars to come back, I'm sorry, you're as far back as they'll go.
Yeah.
It also tells you a few other things, like you're all the way back, you're adjusted all the way back, but typically what adjusts back are the aero bar pads, not the pursuit bars. So if you're on a Speed Concept and you're all the way back in its adjustment motif, then your pursuit bars are going to be sticking way out there. So anytime you're out of the aero position, you're going to be reaching way out there. So sort of sighting where you are inside of these parallelograms tells you how many pedestals you're going to need, whether you need to pull the pads back, push them out, and where the relative position of the pursuit bar is going to be relative to the pads.
I need this.
Yeah.
I want a new...
Yeah, we're making it.
I want a new, like,
so,
super bike.
So you know how you do it right now? You go on the Reader Forum. You start a thread that says, Dan, you ignorant... What bike am I?
Okay.
Because that's... everybody knows. That's the... If you say, Dan, you ignorant... that is code... because if you don't say, that's like as Simon Says, right? You don't say that, then I'm not going to reply.
Okay.
And then I'll go on there and I'll do the math for you and I'll stick it on the forum and I'll tell you what bike you are.
Fantastic. Well, you know what I need to do is I would like to, do you still do bike fits or like the sessions? Do you still teach people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a workshop November 6th through 10.
I'd like to go to a workshop and be your model.
Well, where are you? Okay.
I'm from Reno. We, hey, UNR, we both went to the same college.
You're a Go Mighty Wolfpack?
Yes.
So I know you love Colin Kaepernick, even if you don't like his...
of course, because he's a UNR quarterback.
Yep. You bet. Me too. You either wait a year, and I'll see you at Interbike, and I'll fit you.
Cool.
Or you drive 550 miles south, and I'll fit you. If you want to come down for our workshop, which is November 6th through 10, you can be our guinea pig, and I'll fit you.
I will message that, because I think I'm a hard...
You're not
gangly.
Hard. No, you're not. You're easy. Everybody's easy.
I'm easy.
All you need is a good fitter.
True. And we can. The last podcast we talked all about my fits and stuff, but that would be great.
That would be.
Especially because we're going to do a TT challenge, the three of us, in I think April, and we're all going to race each other. And he usually beats us because it's uphill stuff.
Yeah.
And he used to be a really good TT-er. Then he got old.
Yeah, well, if you're going to do a TT up trying. Mount Rose, then that's not fair.
Exactly. Right. And I was pointing Jonathan beating us uphill and Chad beating us on the flat. So we'll see what happens.
I'll just go start in Sparks, go to Pyramid Lake and back.
So here's a question. This is kind of maybe not everyone applies to, but if I got a fit with you,
yeah,
then I go to the wind tunnel.
Yeah.
And they want to tweak stuff.
Yeah, fine.
Fine.
Good. But see, those are the micro things.
Yeah.
They're not going to change your macro position. Right, you go down to see Jim Manton in Long Beach, and he'll take you to the Carson Velodrome, or he'll take you to the wind tunnel, or the guys at that take you to A2, the wind tunnel guys that worked with Kylie on the sort of crowdsourced wind tunnel test.
Yep.
Members did. So these guys, Heath Dotson, these guys that do that, you know, you go into the wind tunnel and you have them mess with you. My guess is they're not going to mess with the parts of you that is power producing. They're going to mess with the parts of you that is just drag producing.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is to not reduce your power, just reduce your drag. So they're going to fart around with your head position. They're going to put different helmets on you to find the right helmet to match you and your position. They're going to move your elbows in and out. They're going to move your hands up and down. They're going to Levi you, and they're going to, you know, try all the motifs that cause you, you know, that, well, it works for Jesse Thomas. Maybe it'll work for you. Let's try it. And then after that whole process is done, they'll reduce you from, 7 pounds of drag to 6 pounds of drag at 30 miles an hour, but they won't reduce your power. It's my job to make you produce power. It's their job to get that extra pound of drag away from you.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Perfect. All right, Nate, do you have anything else you want to cover on this one?
I think I'm good.
All right. Dan, thank you. We appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Thank
you. Absolutely. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Bye-bye.